Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. He tells us the latest U.S. inflation information had an impact on the stock markets, with money flowing from high tech to the small caps Russell 2000. Ross also tells us that the TSX finally woke up. The Canadian dollar is being shorted something fierce, and that could actually see a boost for the loonie. Ross also gives us his take on the hot cocoa market. Veteran trader Victor Adair joins us from Vancouver Island to take a look at what's driving the markets right now. He gives us his opinion on currencies, especially the nose-diving yen, what's going on with crude, an inverted yield curve, and whether it's giving us a warning about an upcoming recession. Plus, at the end of the show, we'll have a company showcase update with some important news from the Director of Marketing for Recyclico, Tony Mitchell. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Pleasure to be back with you, Jim.
Ross, how would you describe what happened on the stock markets this week?
Well, we finally got some different activity out here. You know, for the last X number of months, what we've seen is just... the high-tech stocks, the AIs, and what used to be the Magnificent Seven then turned into the Magnificent Ten. We're just leading it all the way. The advanced decline line was faltering. If you took a look at the equal-weighted indexes of the S&P or the NASDAQ or the Russell 2000, they basically all topped out in March through April, and we're just languishing here as the big ones and the market cap group just went right through the ceiling. You know, and at the end of it here, we've got the top 10 stocks in the S&P 500 are 37% of the value of the index. So, you know, it goes to show... when those stocks move, the index is immediately affected. So, you know, here we were. We've got the CPI numbers came out yesterday. Inflation acted down 0.1% instead of up 0.1% on the estimates. And, you know, but still a long way up on a six-month or one-year basis. But... it's enough of a move that there is now a what I would call some rate cut optimism out there. And so with that, a real shift in the stocks that are on the move here this last 48 hours. The S&P and NASDAQ took a pretty big hiccup on Thursday and Friday in the early part, only to have a decent bounce back on right into the close on Friday. But the big winners here have been the small cap names, the Russell 2000, and the equal weighted S&P managed to just take off on the upside. There was about a 4.5% move in the Russell versus the S&P on Thursday, one of the biggest moves that we've seen in favor of small caps in well, I was going to say months. It's probably well over a year. So, you know, with this, you know, it could be that we're at this point where, if we're going to have some lower interest rates, that the smaller cap names might be capable of going on for a little bit longer. And, you know, clearly there's some big profits to be had by anybody who's lightening up on the Magnificent Sevens, the NVIDIAs and Apples and Microsofts of this world. So there's money that can move over more to what we would call the fair-valued items. The other market that has finally come to life here in this last week or so has been Toronto. The TSX, which is one of those that topped out in March and just languished. The index went from 22,000 to 22.6 as of Friday. So, and overall, you got a really good 10% move in this last few weeks. So, you know, with a change happening here, and the group that we're sort of in that fear of missing out on the bull market on the high-tech stocks are now taking a look and seeing that there's decent value in these other areas. And, you know, when we take a look at the commitment of traders numbers on the various indices, the Russell 2000 had the lowest commercial net short position and the largest net on the other side of the coin. The speculators had huge net short positions on the Russell 2000 a week ago. We'll see the final numbers at the end of this week, but it clearly there's enough people that have been on the sidelines and betting against this move that the spread of the value-related ones and small caps versus these big names probably continues on for a while.
What's going on with gold?
Well, gold likes what it saw with the CPI numbers because that took the possibility of a rate cut by the Fed. You know, could be July, but most probably out to September. And definitely going to have one, maybe two cuts before the end of the year. So with that, gold had a great week, ended up the tail end of the week here at above $2,426. That is the second highest close that we've seen this year, and a great run. The speculative positions there are such that there might be a little bit of a short covering here, but the style of move that we've had off the low has gone into the same type of overbought condition that we had just before the breakouts back in 2019 and 2024 and 2022. So this triple top that we've had around this 2460 to 2450 level looks as though that could be popped on the upside. You know, initially, I think targets around 2500 should be looked at, but I've got some much higher numbers if we can manage to stay to the upside. Now, within the sector, silver had a decent week, but not nearly as good as the gold market. The mining stocks, though, we take a look at the GDX, the GDXJ, both of those at new highs for the year, good a movement on the upside. You take a look at some of the big names, the Newmonts, the Agnico Egos, just doing exceptionally well a number of days here with breakouts on the upside. It's not just a single day. There's a pretty good amount of momentum there on the upside.
What's going on with crude?
Crude, really just a sort of a backing and filling in there. A week ago, we had seen a decent move to the upside. It got back to $84, but settled back this week to 81. We're at 82.20. Seasonally, we're going to run out of time here on the upside for this move right now. and you'd look more for the stocks there, the XLE and the XEG, U.S. and Canadian sides of the markets for the ETFs, to show some life probably once we get into August. So a bit of a pause here in the oil market wouldn't be at all of a surprise. Nothing big happening on the commitment of traders numbers there to give us any guidance. So just a bit of a backing and filling process.
What's happening with the U.S. dollar?
Well, the dollar we were looking for it to top out in July. The cycle that we're dealing with typically we were looking for about a 5 to 6 week rally on the upside and then down into September. It rolled over a few days earlier than one would have expected, but definitely at this point was starting down at the beginning of the week, and then with the CPI numbers and the dollar really took it on the nose here on Thursday with follow through on Friday. So we're looking at the lowest close that we've seen since the 1st of April. I think, you know, there's still some time to be had on the downside. We might be a little oversold. I mean, this thing is had been up above the 20 and 50 day moving averages 10 days ago, up around 106, and here we are at 103.75. Pretty fast drop in the span of this couple of weeks. So might be a bit of a bounce in here, but I think the overhead resistance in the 104.25 to 104.50 is pretty likely, especially because the cycles, the short-term cycles, runs about 56 to 58 days. That one has just topped, just to say, probably got the better part of more than a month to go on the downside before it finds its low. On the other side of the coin, if the dollar is going to remain weak like it is, then that should be positive for the gold and the silver market.
What's going on with the Canadian dollar?
Canadian, pretty quiet week overall here. We had those just a record number of short positions, the speculative positions, and I thought that we had a pretty good chance for a short covering rally. The rally has been small in proportion to what might have happened. You know, we were at 72.75 10 days ago. We rallied to 73.5, which is just up to the resistance level of the last couple of months. If it takes out the 73.5, there's enough shorts in here, the speculative shorts, that it could fuel a pretty decent move. The moving averages, the 20 and the 50 day, which give you decent intermediate signals, you know, a nice sell a year ago in July up around 75.5, a nice buy signal down at 73 in November, a sell again in January. Now we've just in this last week got a crossover to the upside. So it could be that there'll be some upside action on the Canadian dollar. And if the U.S. rates are going to narrow come towards the Canadian, then once again, that would be of assistance to the Canadian dollar.
What's going on with uranium?
Well, this had been, you know, one of the big, big winners in the fourth quarter of last year, right into the first quarter this year. We got up around 106, got lots of good sell signals in that last week or so of the run. Very deep correction. Initially down to 84. We've been consolidating since then, and this consolidation has now got itself to the point where we have backed off and we're just sitting right now around the 50-week moving average. And this is very typical when you've had one of those explosive upside moves, when we get in what we call exhaustion signals on the upside. You look for a couple of waves of selling. So the first one was to the 84 and change level. We bounced back over 90. Then we've come back down and retested the 84 level. That then puts us into a position where it can base out in here. And if we look at some of the big names like the Cameco's and Denison's, they've filled in pretty well as well. If anything, they've got some nice double bottoms here in the last 3 or 4 weeks. So I think this market, for all that it's gone quiet and people aren't talking about it anymore, wouldn't be at all surprised that it comes to life. And, you know, there are, you don't have to go for the individual stocks. There are some ETFs, the URNM and the URNJ are good ETFs that you can take a look at. And, definitely the two ETFs found good support at their 50-week moving averages within this last 2 weeks.
Is cocoa still worth almost its weight in gold?
No, cocoa is just, well, let's put it, it was one of those that, you know, had the big run, and then, so this thing ran to, what, 11,700, gave back 4,000 of that, coming down to 7,000, and the trading range since then has been pretty big. The bounce was to 10,000, so it recovered a good 60% of the whole decline. And that decline, you know, only took about a week, so pretty darn fast. And the bounce was pretty good. It's been testing its 7,000 level, I guess, now. This is, what, three times it's been there, in May and June and now again in July. And like the uranium, and actually like a lot of things out there, that 50-week moving average is right now at about 6,800 on the cocoa. So, you know, the major trend is up. It might be forming a top up here, but the key to watch for in these things is to, you know, you can be nimble trying to take the short side for a while, but you want to be very aware of the fact that the dominant trend is still up. I would say until we break that 6,800 level, you know, it's got a chance on the upside. Now, I understand that there was a lot of hedging done by some of the people like Hershey's. And so not all of the price increase has been passed along as of yet, but if we stay up here, those chocolate bars are going to get pretty rich.
I was going to say, can we afford Halloween and Christmas this year?
Well, you know, if it stays up here much longer, we're going to be heading out to one bar instead of two bars to most of the kids.
Ross, anything else that caught your eye this week?
The other thing we want to keep an eye on, in terms of the equity markets, you know, we're going to keep an eye on the credit side of the equation. And the CCC spread, which is the high yield spread differential, looking at the Bank of Montreal or the Bank of America Merrill Lynch yield versus the government yields. And that has been moving along and being good for the market since October of 2022. This week has come around the corner and the spread is starting to widen out. It's at the point where if it goes any further than what we saw this week, it will give a sell signal. And the buy and sell signals on that spread have been really good as far as the big picture is concerned. The type of signals that you get only every couple of years, and when they do come into place, you can get some pretty significant action. We put out a chart on that for clients earlier this week, and clearly, if you know, one glance at that one and at a good 20-year history on it will show that we have to be, at this point, pretty cautious when we're looking at the credit side of the equation.
Ross, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Good to be with you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on X at Charts by Ross. Coming up, Victor Adair, next on This Week in Money.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Victor Adair, recently retired from nearly 50 years of being in the brokerage business in BC, but he's still very active in the markets. His website, victoradair.ca, he's speaking to us from Parksville on beautiful Vancouver Island. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Well, Jim, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Victor, it's the middle of summer. Lots of people are on vacation. The stock market keeps making new highs. Before we discuss individual markets, what do you think are the key issues investors are considering?
Probably what to put on the barbecue. To be serious, it is the middle of summer. And as my friend Dennis Gartman would say years ago, you know, the adults have left the building and the kids are on the trading desk. And it kind of feels that way, where we had some very choppy price action certainly in the equity markets this week. But, what are the key issues investors are thinking about here? Top of the list probably is what's the Fed going to do? And, you know, that's just been top of the list for so long, it's hard to forget. But we had a key number this week that was the CPI data on Thursday morning. And, I mean, it's always complicated, and there's people that can burrow into the data like, you know, worms into a piece of wood or something. But on balance, okay, the stock market took it as more of a confirmation that the Fed's going to cut interest rates this year, cut them twice, you know, say starting in September and then again in December. And, the market's been kind of looking for that. I did write a piece, if it was this week or last week, where I thought that maybe if the market saw the Fed cutting interest rates, it would not be the green light special that I've talked about the past 2 years or so, almost like ever since the Fed started to raise rates. I felt that, you know, the market would get really excited, you know, oh boy, the Fed's cutting rates, so buy everything that's not nailed down. And I'm kind of changing my tune on that to think that the market could see a Fed cut as defensive, you know, that they're cutting rates because things aren't good. You know, that's not necessarily a good reason to be a buyer of stocks here. But what is happening is the market is on a rip to the upside. The S&P, I think, and I'm just doing this by memory, but I think the S&P has closed higher for 11 of the last 12 weeks. That's up about 14-15%. You annualize that comes out to, you know, north of 50%. I mean, that's the kind of tear that we've been on here as spring has turned into summer. And, you know, why is that? The quant types out there would tell you that it's because earnings expectations are going up, so people are willing to pay a higher price per share of earnings or just even sales. So that seems to be what it is. People, a year ago this time were worried there was going to be a recession. That doesn't seem to be a worry anymore, although from where I sit, I see a lot of aspects of the economy softening, certainly even employment. And so that's another issue, you know, where do we go from here with the economy? So a lot of things on people's mind, but it doesn't matter if you're a trader. It's just, you know, the stock market's been on this strong bullish trend. We made new all-time highs again this week in most of the indices. And one of the really interesting events, last week in my blog I said, you know, here's big cap tech leaving the rest of the market behind. Well, 4 days later, it was whammo on that idea as big tech dropped sharply on Thursday and the lowly Russell 2000 index of small cap stocks, which had been trading below where it closed last year, just took off like a scalded cat to the upside. So you might call that rotation, as money leaves one aspect of the market and goes to another sector. But yeah, it's summertime. You know, what was that old movie, Chinatown, with Jack Nicholson? And near the end of the movie, one of the guys pulls him aside and said, Jake, you know, like, don't worry about it. It's Chinatown. Well, it kind of feels like that. It's summer. You know, is that any of this real? Will it be real when we come back to, you know, when the adults get back in the room after Labor Day? You know, we'll see.
The headline on your trading desk notes last week was Big Cap Tech Leaves the Rest of the Market Behind. The NASDAQ rallied again this week, but so did most of the other indices. Is capital rotating away from Big Cap Tech?
Yeah, I guess I kind of half answered that with what I was just saying. You know, I kind of doubt it. Big Cap Tech has just been so important. It's like without it, you know, the stock market wouldn't have gone anywhere this year. And in a class by itself, it has left the rest of the markets behind. There, I guess the hopeful view is all of the money that's been made in big cap tech, and especially, you know, the AI stocks and that sort of thing, if people take some of that money away because they've made so much, you know, and start to allocate it to some of the other stocks in the indices, then, you know, we'll have a broader rally because breadth has been horrible. And, you know, it'll just be another way of sustaining. It's kind of like the question would be, what does it take for the market to keep going up? Well, you know, there's capital to go to other things that have been left behind. So, yeah, I think there is a prospect of some rotation. But I got to be honest with you. I mean, I'm more inclined to think that, and this is not, you know, this is not me, the strategist for some bank firm or something like that. This is just me, a trader with 50 years of painful lessons and everything else of that. I think the market is just goofy to the upside here. That's my bias. I am frustrated, I guess, as well, that, you know, the market has just surged higher, and I'm wrong about that. But, you know, that's kind of my thinking here. And when I said big cap tech leaves the rest of the market behind, I'm just thinking this is sort of the thing that would happen at or around an important top. So that's what I think about that.
The American CPI report on Thursday was the marquee scheduled event of the week. What effect did it have on the markets? Because for the first time, inflation went down month to month since we had the pandemic.
Yeah. Well, the effect was on different markets. Now, the main market, in a way, well, let's do it this way. Why is CPI important? Well, CPI is one of the measures of inflation. Is it all that good and accurate? You know, who knows? Let's not go there. But it's just one of those, as you say, marquee numbers. And it's important because the most important thing is, what's the Fed going to do? And what the Fed is going to do is going to depend on inflation. So the CPI kind of maybe tells us ahead of time what the Fed's going to do. So as I said earlier, the data was well received by the market. The idea was that, okay, the Fed's going to cut interest rates, or at least it confirmed that notion. And that was on the interest rate markets. So then we went to the stock market, and interestingly enough, here it was, that was Thursday morning. The number came out before, like about an hour before the floor session opens, as we used to call it, on the exchanges. And the leading stock futures that were trading at the time, the S&P and the NASDAQ, both rallied to new all-time highs, and within 15 minutes were back below where they had been when that number came out. So the stock market, it seemed, that day, and as the day wore on, the NASDAQ built momentum to the downside, that this was one of those classic sort of buy the rumor, sell the news events, where, you know, the market had been rising into this event, and then when the event got announced and it was bullish, oops, the markets fall. So for a lot of traders, that's the kind of thing you just dream of when a market fails on some bullish news. So that seemed to be what happened to stocks. And the NASDAQ was down hard on Thursday. S&P was down because it's got some aspect of some weighting, say 30% of big cap tech in it. The Dow and the Russell were off on a different path entirely. So that's interest rates. On the currency side, the U.S. dollar was weaker with the prospect of the Fed cutting rates, and I guess that's not a surprise. And the gold market, rose, and again, that would not be a surprise for the gold market to be up on the idea that the Fed would be cutting.
What are your thoughts on interest rates?
Okay, here's something I've written about the last 2 weeks, and that's the yield curve. And the yield curve right now is inverted. In other words, short-term interest rates are higher than long-term rates. And, forgive me if I get the numbers wrong, but just like kind of at a ballpark level, we got short rates at, let's say, 5.25, and the 10-year is going to be about, at least a full percentage point below that. Typically, over a long multi-year horizon, longer-term interest rates are higher than short-term interest rates. So why is the market inverted now? Well, the Fed has jammed up the short rates in their attempt or their program, the process, to try to kill or contain or get inflation down. And the long end hasn't had the same reaction. And you might even say, the long end has stayed, the yields are lower because if the Fed does slow the economy and that does get inflation down, then people like to buy bonds. I think that yield curve has had its max inversion and is going to go the other way. I think we're going to go to, and this is, by the way, the time frame is important on this. This is probably over the next many months that we would see short rates fall to be lower than long rates. Now the way the short rate come down, the Fed cuts rates and the rates on the long end might not fall as much if you want to see the yield curve change, because the long end might be looking at the government having to issue more bonds to fund their their programs. And of course they are issuing more bonds, borrowing more money than they're taking in taxes, so they're running deficits, and that's a pressure on the bond market. Anyway, that's sort of my main interest in the interest rate market right now is how would I trade that idea of the yield curve changing from being inverted to being in a normal condition.
Now, there's kind of conventional thinking when you have an inverted yield curve, it kind of predicts a recession. Are you in that camp?
And not reluctantly, but it's like coincidentally, I guess. I absolutely understand that you go back, I guess, easily 50 years, maybe you go back to the Second World War, something like that, that there has always been a recession following a yield curve inversion. So, if we're looking at the yield curve, I should say an inversion and then going back to normal, that maybe when I say I think it's going to happen, I do see a recessionary environment because the Fed's going to be lowering short rates faster than long rates. So to me, it's more coincidental, but yes, I'd agree with you.
In your weekly blog, you've written about speculators having a massive net short position in Canadian dollar futures. Why do you think that's happening, and how do you expect it to play out?
Okay. There's a... The regulator for the commodity business is called the CFTC, the Commodity Futures and Trading Commission, and they issue a report every week called the Commitment of Traders Data. That comes out on Friday afternoon, and it's as of the Tuesday just preceding. And that shows you not names of people, but by styles of people. So they have large speculators, small speculators, and then what we would call commercials. And then there are some other classes, but those are the three main ones. And what you look for is the commercials are people that are like trading in whatever the market that is all the time, whether it's corn or wheat or Canadian dollars or gold. Those are commercials. And then there's the speculators, and there's little speculators, retail, and then there's much bigger ones, you know, hedge funds and that sort of thing. So kind of one of the theories, and what some of the, I've paid attention to this data for, I guess it's 35 years or so. The commercials, say are more likely right, because that's what they do for a living. And they, that's all they do, you know, that they're trading those markets. Whereas the speculators are a bit of macro tourists, you know, one day they're trading corn, the next day they're trading live hogs or something, and the next day they're trading cocoa. So they kind of flitter around here and there. So they're probably not as informed about things as the as the commercials are. But from time to time, the speculators get it right. And when the commercials are wrong, then the market really moves, in favor of the speculators. Now, to answer your question, why are the speculators getting so short of the Canadian dollar? So first of all, I don't know. You know, you may think you know, and the market might move in line with your thought, and it may move in line with your thought for reasons that you never thought of, but that's just so it's coincidental. But I would say it's kind of an interest rate play. Right now, short-term rates in Canada are lower than those in the United States, and that is unusual in my 50-some years of trading. Usually, Canadian short rates are higher than American rates, and when Canadian short rates are lower, that usually means the Canadian dollar is weakening. So there's that. Another thing tied to interest rates is there's technical term, a hell of a lot of mortgages need to be refinanced in Canada in the next, this year and into next year. And rates are way higher than they were when those mortgages were put on, let's say in the last 3 to 5 years. So the people who have the, hold those mortgages, if they go out and get refinanced, it's going to take a bigger chunk of their monthly income to meet those mortgage payments. So that might mean consumers are going to spend less, the economy will slow down, you know, and one of the currency market's reaction, if the Canadian economy slowed relative to the American one, the Canadian dollar would go lower. Now, there may be some other reasons, but those are two sort of things that you could figure out, reasons as to why the speculators are so short. The other part of your question is, how does this play out? Okay. Speculators are short, commercials are long, the Canadian dollar. If the Canadian dollar starts to go down, the speculators, in effect, might say, hey, look at this, I'm right. Let's do some more. Let's press the position. Let's add to a winning trade. And the Canadian dollar is now trading, say, within a cent or so of the lows that it's had the last few years. If it drifted down or fell down, you know, to those levels or below, that might draw attention from people you never heard of before. They're saying, hey, look at this market over here. It's breaking down. And other people would jump on it. So I think the Canadian dollar, which, by the way, has just been dead in the water here for the last week or 10 days or so in terms of trading. I mean, tiny ranges going nowhere, like it's summertime. If the Canadian dollar breaks down, then the downbreak could be accelerated by the weight of these speculators. On the other hand, talking like an economist, if the Canadian dollar for some reason starts to rally, these guys that are short may have to throw in the towel, say, hey, we're wrong. Well, what do they need to do? They need to go buy the Canadian dollar to cover their shorts. So Canada's been in a fairly narrow range, let's say a couple of cents here for the past many, many months. And if we break out of that range one way or the other, we're probably going to accelerate either to the upside or the downside. So maybe long story short, but that's kind of what I think.
What developments in other currency markets have your attention?
Well, one you can't miss is the Japanese yen. The Japanese yen this week was trading at fresh 34-year lows against the U.S. dollar in the interbank market, we call it. The Japanese yen had traded up above, took over 161 yen by a dollar. That is a decline in the yen of more than 50% from the all-time highs that hit against the U.S. dollar back at the very end of 2011. At the beginning of 2012, the Prime Minister introduced his Three Arrows program to try to do what they could to get the Japanese out of what had been a two-decades-long depression. Or, that's too strong a word, but certainly a very, very sluggish economy. So there's an old idea, mercantilist idea, that if you want your economy to go up, get your currency down, and then anything you export to other people will look cheap to them, and they'll buy your exports, and, you know, you rev up your economy. Well, basically, all of Asia is doing that. The Asian currencies are all way lower than, you know, they should be, and put parentheses around should, quotation marks, I should say. But, you know, it works. So the Japanese economy is going to be stronger. At least exports from Japan will more likely get bought, okay, and create income for the Japanese companies at home. So now, in the last April, the authorities came in, intervened, tried to keep the yen from falling any further, and they sort of failed because it didn't work. I mean, the yen rallied a bit for a couple of days and then started falling to new lows. So now they were in again this week, intervening, and we'll see. If it's just the Japanese and not other countries, and in this case, let's say the United States, that they're helping out, the intervention may not work. I talked about the currency spread or the interest rate spread on currencies before with Canada, the U.S. On the yen, it's way worse. So we're 5.25 on short rates in the United States. We're about 0.25 on short rates in Japan. So if you're a Japanese entity, you're leaving 5 percentage points a year on the table to be in yen instead of being in U.S. dollars. That's very powerful. Force to cause people to sell yen and buy the U.S. dollar. So I'm paying a lot of attention to what's going on with the yen. Mexican peso got absolutely clobbered on the election last month, thinking that the stock market, thinking that the ruling party may now be almost, you know, able to do whatever the hell they want. There's no effective opposition. And again, on interest rates, I mean, short rates in Mexico are now around 11%, so there's a huge pickup if you want to be long Mexican peso, short the U.S. dollar, or, you know, the all-time greatest trade ever was to be short the Japanese yen and long the Mexican peso for the last, since COVID. It was an incredible move. So those are some of the sort of things I pay attention to in the currency markets.
Gold closed this week only $50 below May's all-time highs, up about $100 from last week's lows. What do you think about gold?
Yeah, I've been a little puzzled on gold. Honestly, I guess I thought it maybe ran for the roses when it made its high. And when was that? It feels like it was about a month ago. I should look at my screens, but I'll just try to stay focused here. When it did make its highs, some of the services I pay attention to and subscribe to were pointing out that the volume on the Shanghai Futures Exchange just went through the roof. And I really paid attention to that because I'd been thinking that I could see there would be a lot of reasons why, let's say, well-to-do people in China might want to buy some gold, given the world they live in over there. And if you had the opportunity to buy gold, you know, even if it wasn't going up, you might say, you know, I'd like to own some gold. But now that it was going up, people just really jumped on a bandwagon, and I wrote in my blog a few times that I thought the top in gold had been defined by aggressive, leveraged buying by retail accounts in China. Okay, so to me, when that happens, that's a top of some kind, you know, and there may be some fallout after that. So that was kind of where I thought gold was at, and it did. I think it fell back maybe $200 or so from those highs. But I got to be honest here. In the last week or two, it's been creeping back higher again. I see the open interest. That's how we measure how many players are, how many positions are being held in the futures markets, is back at about a two-year high. And the positioning of speculators against commercials, as I described that earlier, is at a two-year high in gold, with the speculators on gold long. So that's the situation there. And, you know, the people who are predisposed to be bullish on gold would have any number of very good reasons, you know, why you want to be long gold. And I'm seeing the way the market looks here technically, that especially if we rally some more here and take out those previous highs that were defined by the Chinese speculators, gold could really take a jump higher.
When we talked a month ago, copper dropped about 70 cents a pound from its record highs in May. It's bounced back the past couple of weeks. Will we see new highs for Dr. Copper?
You know, I suppose the easy answer would be, I suppose, at some time. I don't know how long it'll take. I mean, I did sort of tongue-in-cheek say that the rally in copper that we had, it took us to the highs, I think that was in May, was people were believing this story, as I call it, and I don't mean that to be pejorative, it was just the narrative, and maybe that's more polite, that there was going to be the electrification of everything, you know. Everybody was going to have an electric car, and everything was going to be electric. We wouldn't burn oil anymore, or, on and on and on. And, of course, if that's the case, then surely there isn't enough copper to be had. You know, and when you have a market that is demanding something and it's in short supply, voila, you know, prices go up. So I could see people getting into the copper market thinking, hey, I got this figured out. Look at, there's huge demand. There's a shortage. The price has got nowhere to go up. I got to be a buyer. And sort of my sardonic sidebar on that one was, who doesn't know that story? I mean, if you heard it, believe me, you're the last guy to hear it. Everybody knows that story. It's been out there for, I don't know, 5 years. And we have ups and downs. So copper did have this race to the upside. And by the way, the Shanghai market was definitely involved in that one as well. And we defined a top and fell, I don't know, we fell about 70, 80 cents from a $5 level. So whatever that is, in percentage terms, but a pretty sharp setback. And it's a kind of a classic pattern where a market just races away, becomes parabolic with retail falling all over themselves to get into the market, and we set back. So it seems to have found kind of a level, but now there's other things in play. Okay, well, there's other demand for copper, and maybe who knows what the warehouse supplies are, and on and on and on, and maybe it's a little more of a two-way street instead of buyers only. Will we see new highs? You know, I would imagine, yes, at some time, without being sarcastic. I mean, there is some substance to the electrification of everything story, you know? You just don't have to read too much about the electric grids around the world to think we need a hell of a lot more copper, let alone, you know, electric cars and trucks and everything else.
West Texas crude has rallied about $12 in just over a month. What are your thoughts on the energy markets?
Well, let's go back to the Russian invasion of Ukraine in end of February of 22. So just 2 years, 24, about 28 months ago. Crude ran up to $130 a barrel, WTI, that is. And that's the highest I think we've seen since we printed 147 back in July of 08. The price came back down pretty quick from the Russian invasion, because it turned out that, you know, crude wasn't suddenly totally scarce and you couldn't get any anywhere. For the last 2 years, broadly speaking, okay, WTI has traded in a band of $70 to $90. Now, there's been a couple of times it's poked its head out or its tail out on either side of that range, but, you know, that's kind of where we've been. So, you know, we've run up back to around $82, $84 here this week. That's near the higher end of the range. I haven't been as active. In fact, I've hardly done anything in crude oil for a while. I've just been more active in the financial markets. But, you know, I guess the big thing is on the, I think it's more a demand side. I mean, the production side's pretty much known. And I say pretty much, but I mean, the OPEC people have cut back their production to try to support prices And, you know, they could stop those cutbacks. But we're talking about, you know, 1 or 2% of global total production. It's the demand side, I think, that is the puzzle. And, you know, China seems to have been in a demand slowdown for 2 years without any prospect of, like, come roaring back. If, in fact, there is a recession, as we talked about earlier, that might reduce demand as well. So, you know, the markets, it's a bid and an offer. So it's trading in a range, and that's that. I mean, another market on the energy side is natural gas. And, I mean, holy mackerel, natural gas makes crude oil look like it's, you know, flatter than a pancake. Natural gas is just seems to rip from pillar to post. Earlier this year, February, April kind of period, crude, natural gas, I should say, was trading at 20 or so year lows. And I think I described it then. It was like effectively the cheapest it had ever been, you know, if you factor in inflation over the last 20 or 30 years. And then it doubled by June. And in, from the June highs, we're down 30% or so from where we were 4 weeks ago. So, as I say, natural gas really whips around, and that makes crude oil, the crude oil look kind of quiet. I think just for the Canadians that would be listening in particular, the completion of the Trans Mountain Pipeline is not a total game changer, but it's important. We're going to be able to export 500,000 barrels or so a day that we couldn't export before, and export to other countries besides the United States. I mean, some of that oil coming from over from Alberta will certainly go to the American West Coast. But what I see is that the prices of Canadian crude, and there's different benchmarks, and one's called Western Canada Select, but basically Canadian crude's traded at a discount to WTI. Well, that discount isn't as big as it used to be now that we got another opportunity to sell oil to other customers other than the United States. And to carry on that, where are we at here? July of 2024, but a year or so from now, we're going to be scheduled anyway to be exporting LNG off the west coast of British Columbia up out of the Prince Rupert, Kitimat area up there. So, you know, these are good things for the Canadian economy to have different markets for our energy products, and especially if the Canadian dollar weakens and the energy industry is selling energy to the rest of the world in U.S. dollar prices, the industry is going to be making a lot of money. So that's maybe a bit of a sidebar thing, but I think that's really important for Canada to have an export facility to get our energy products to other markets and create that income for the country.
The AI mania that's sweeping the markets right now, does this remind you of the dot-com bubble back in 2000? Just put AI on the name of anything and money will be thrown at it?
Yes. Of course. I mean, I certainly lived through those markets. And, you know, accelerating the rally into the end of 1999 was the Federal Reserve cutting interest rates. You know, you can imagine the market was going straight up and the Fed was cutting rates because they were worried, remember, about when we went to the year 2000, maybe a lot of computers wouldn't work because they weren't programmed for, you know, to be able to handle that date. Well, that turned out to not be a problem, or at least people got on it and fixed it if it was. But, yeah, we had in Vancouver, we used to have the Vancouver Stock Exchange still then, and a whole lot of companies that were, you know, Rip Snort Mining Inc. changed their name to ripsnortmining.com, and the share price would double overnight. Now, I'm being sarcastic, but, yeah, that's kind of how it was. And then there's the great story of Cisco, you know, which the chairman of, or president, whatever he was, of Cisco, basically saying, what the hell were people thinking? You know, they were paying something like 60 times sales for the share price, and that meant I had to, you know, perform impossible things to meet their expectations, and he was right, you know, and the share price of Cisco made a dramatic fall when it finally had reached its peak and went down. So, yeah, and I said maybe at the very top of this interview, people of my age who've seen a lot of ups and downs in markets, you know, you think, oh, I've seen this before. Yeah, I've seen this before. People are throwing money at the market. They don't really know what they're buying, but it's going up, so they buy more. And, yeah, it usually, as Bob Farrell, the famous analyst at Merrill Lynch years ago, he has his 10 rules. I mean, people just Google Bob Farrell, F-A-R-R-E-L, maybe two L's, and get the 10 rules. But one of his is markets that make these fantastic runs up or down do not correct by just going sideways. You know, you get these dramatic reversals. So we had a dramatic reversal that kind of the market peaked out in March of 2000, I should say. And, yeah, we had a pretty dramatic fall. And yes, what's happening now does remind me of those times. And I'll put the caveat on there that markets that are racing to the upside very likely go further to the upside than you can imagine before they turn and go down. So you got to be careful trying to short them.
On your weekly blog at victoradair.ca, you talk about several different markets, but you often write a section you call Thoughts on Trading, which deals with trading techniques, risk management, the psychology of trading. What are you going to write about this week?
You know, I don't know yet.
How insightful our interview was this week.
No, I tell you, I try to be with my blog, and you know, my blog is free. People don't have to pay for it, and that way I don't really have any obligation to clients. I could just quit at any time. And I had clients for 45 years or so in the brokerage business, and I kind of happily don't have clients. But when I say I'm being honest, and it's free to read what I put there, I've not had a good week in terms of trading. Now, what that means is I lost money this week, and I would probably write something about that. But one of the other aspects of my blog is what I call the trading life. And I did an interview with some folks a couple of weeks ago, and one of the questions was, how much money do you need to have in your account if you're going to trade for a living? I thought, well, okay, that's pretty... Okay, let's do it this way. How much money do you need annually, you know, to live if you haven't got any income coming from some other source? And let's say, just pick a number, let's say, you know, your expenses are going to be down, you're working from home and all that sort of thing, but you could get by on $50,000 a year of net income. Maybe, you know, somebody else in your family is also working and whatnot. Okay, so what do you think you could make for returns? Well, you figure you can make 10%? Okay, well then right now we know you need $500,000 in your account to, you know, make a living of 50 grand a year. But the thing is with trading, it's not like a stream of income or like a regular paycheck because, you know, you go up and down and you have weeks like the one I just had here where I'm on the wrong side of the rally. I think the rally's gone too far and so I'm selling short the stock market and getting stopped out and losing some money. Now, the thing is with me, I trade very small size relative to my account, so it's not like I'm going to be out on the street begging for food. But it's still, it's the psychological thing of saying, how could I be so wrong? You know, I'm so experienced. I've done this for years and years and years. How could I be so wrong? And, you know, it just happens. And you kind of have to live with it, you know, keep your risk managed to the point where, you know, you're not really blue or down about it. But it just kind of, you get a little pissed off and say, what was I thinking? Why did I do that? And, you know, then next week the market's open, you got to go back to work. So probably something like that.
Victor, thank you so much for chatting with us and being on This Week in Money.
Tim, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. I know I run on a bit, but I think it's obvious that I'm enthusiastic about what I do.
My guest has been Victor Adair, recently retired from nearly 50 years of being in the brokerage business in BC. He was speaking to us from Vancouver Island. His website, victoradair.ca. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark and Victor Adair. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or for our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Now stand by for a company showcase update from the Director of Marketing for Recyclico, Tony Mitchell. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen. Welcome to Company Showcase, an advertising feature on HowStreet.com.
I'm Jim Goddard. My guest is Tony Mitchell, Director of Marketing for Recyclico. Welcome back to Company Showcase.
Hey, Jim.
How are things in the world of Recyclico?
Well, Jim, I'm happy to report that we're now a revenue-generating enterprise.
Congratulations. I wasn't expecting to hear the news for another year or so.
Well, thanks, Jim. We announced the news in a press release this week, and it's largely come as a surprise to our loyal investors, and we're looking forward to taking additional steps in that direction in the coming months. Now, it's important to keep in mind that while the revenue is small at this stage, this is a major milestone for the company, as it marks our transition from, you know, years of being a venture stage company into a revenue generating global industrial enterprise. I personally like to think of it, you know, myself anyways, as the first dollar you see framed on the wall at a new restaurant after it opens. You know, while that dollar, you know, won't sustain operations, it will always serve as a proud reminder of where we started when we look back in our past operations generating much greater revenue.
So how was the company able to generate revenue so early?
Well, you see, Jim, part of the extensive list of equipment required to get our joint venture fully operational is stage one, battery discharging and grinding equipment. And since we purchased and recently received that equipment in Taiwan, we thought it made sense to install, process off-spec battery scrap and sell on the refined black powder in advance of getting the rest of our stage two plant operational late next year. And I've said this in previous podcasts, but, you know, James Fang, the chairman of our Taiwan joint venture, who's a great guy, has been busy leveraging the great relationships he's built over decades in the battery industry. So in addition to overseeing and preparing to get our plant fully operational, he lined up an ongoing supply of off-spec cathode scrap from one such relationship he has with an established global battery manufacturer, process their battery scrap and sell the higher value black powder to another well-established customer.
So does this mean Recyclico will only be doing stage one battery recycling now?
No, Jim, certainly not. We have no intention of being only a stage one recycler. As I've stated many times before, there's a big difference between both a stage one and a stage two. You know, stage one, discharging end-of-life batteries, grinding them up into black mass, and considering the batteries recycled, like so many other lithium-ion battery recyclers, I say again, you know, recyclers and recycling in air quotes, is only one part of the multiple steps required to upcycle battery scrap into battery-ready materials that can be reused in new battery production. But ultimately, this equipment will be used to pre-process the battery scrap we'll be putting through our stage two patented hydrometallurgical recycling process. So while we have this component on site, it just made logical fiscal sense to start generating revenue now by putting in lower value battery scrap and outputting a higher value black powder instead of, you know, waiting for all of the other components required for our process to be delivered, installed, and commissioned late next year.
I remember you mentioning black mass on a previous podcast. So what's black powder?
Yeah, I've had a few people reach out to me for clarity on that, as black powder isn't discussed much outside the battery industry. Basically, Jim, black mass is typically produced from discharged and ground up end of life or fully produced batteries. Depending on the physical state of the input material and the battery chemistry, this may include aluminum from the battery casing, plastics and binders, as well as the valuable base metal elements such as nickel, cobalt, lithium, etc., found within cathode materials. Whereas, you know, black powder is typically produced from off-spec battery production scrap, like cathode scrap and whatnot, and is most times only made up of cathode or electrode materials, depending upon where it was taken off the line during the various steps of inspection and quality control found in the battery production facility. So in essence, black powder is a much more highly valued material than black mass. As when it comes to battery recycling, it's like working with a super concentrated feedstock packed full of only the materials you want versus having to remove many of the impurities found in black mass. That's, you know, and that's not to say those who are currently buying our black powder will be able to profitably recover all of the valuable battery materials locked within this material. But when our patented hydrometallurgical clean spot is fully operational next year, we will be able to recover 99% of those highly valuable battery materials locked within this black powder or black mass, and sell battery-ready PCAM, precursor cathode active material, and lithium products, hydroxide or carbonate. And we produce these in much fewer steps for a much higher value to a base of clientele that's been established between now and then. So, you know, it's really, everyone here at Recycleco are excited and looking forward to our clean spot being fully operational next year, Jim. And at that point, maybe we can frame and place a much higher denomination bill on the wall in our office.
For people new to the company, what is Recycleco all about and where are you traded?
Well, we're a battery recycling and upcycling company for lithium-ion batteries, primarily focused on being located inside or alongside of a battery production facility or a recycling facility that, you know, produces black mass and black powder, like I'm suggesting and talking about today. And basically, we're traded on the TSX Venture under the ticker symbol AMY. On the OTCQB under the ticker symbol AMYZF, and on the Frankfurt Stock Exchange under the ticker symbol ID4. And you can get more information on our website at any time at recycleco.com.
Tony, thank you so much for the update.
Thank you, Jim.
I've been speaking with Tony Mitchell, Director of Marketing for Recycleco. I'm Jim Goddard. Our conversation took place on July 11th.
Comments made on Company Showcase are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at HowStreet.com. Company Showcase is a production of How Street Media Incorporated.